Thank you. Welcome all. Let me introduce George. George and I go back at least 12 years.
Yes.
And we were introduced by a mutual friend, Michael Baer.
Yep.
And he said to me, George is different.
And I'm not sure whether that's a compliment.
Well, no.
But you're open-minded.
In my view, it's different. He is a very competent CPA with a sense of humor. How many of them do you find? He's been with Ernst & Young. He's got over 30 years' experience serving multinational companies. That includes M&As, transactions, IPOs. His clients include Steam Global Services, Active Packet, Internoc, Phase Forward, ATG, Glasshouse Technologies, Powerspan, and Skillsoft. He's a member of the board of the Massachusetts Society of CPAs. He's an adjunct lecturer at the Boston College Carroll Graduate School of Management, and he received his BS from Boston.
I got lucky. But it's also BD, Larry. But thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Larry, very much. Yeah. Thank you for getting me the opportunity. Appreciate getting a chance to talk to all of you. A little add-on to the background. I'll sit for a minute, given the madness today. But I am BC, BD, though, before Doug. So for anyone remembering Doug Flutie through the pass against Miami, 1984. I'll never forget presenting at a board meeting for a private client that the chair of the board actually happened to have been the dean of admissions from BC. In front of you who've either been BC grads or have friends or family who have tried to get in. The year I applied to BC, which was 1973, he reminded me that BC had 2,400 applications, and they took 2,300 people. For any of you who know now, which as I was making my presentation, I'm like, is he trying to tell me I'm a dope? Maybe. But there, as for any of you know, the school, once Doug Flutie threw a pass against Miami about 55, 60 yards, went to the Cotton Bowl, put them on the map. I think this year there's 33,000 applications, so I got lucky. Thank you, Larry. But no, I appreciate the intro and the opportunity to speak with you. And as Larry said, this is a PowerPoint-free zone, but I do just have about a piece to that's got a couple of things to hopefully generate some thoughts. But my career has been 33 years of being in this role of being an auditor. And the funny story I like to tell, and it's nice that you talked about Arthur D. Little, my mother. For years never understood clearly what I was doing as a career. And before Ernst & Young, I spent 24 years firm also with my friend John Millerick here at Arthur Andersen, the last of the big five, which when the music died in 2002 disappeared. And my mother could never get a kind of confused whether I worked at Arthur D. Little, Anderson Little, you know, the ones who sell the suits and all that stuff. And, you know, lives in Florida, does the water aerobics in the morning, everything. And then in March 2002, when Anderson got indicted, being a partner there for 24 years, I remember calling her and she said, you know, I always thought you worked for Arthur D. Little or Anderson D. I said, well, Arthur D. Little Consulting, Anderson Little Selling Clothes, Arthur Andersen Accounting. And she said, you guys are bad guys. And I was like, you guys are bad guys. And I remember saying, I might call my mother by her first name, which is many hours of therapy, which you don't need to hear about. But I said, Connie, you guys, I'm one of those partners. She said, you know, you're in bed with bad people. And I said, thanks for the note. You should have told me 24 years ago. I should have gone and worked for Arthur D. Little. But anyway, so thank you for giving me a chance to come out and talk to you and hopefully engage in some discussion. I do have and again, PowerPoint freeze home. That was Larry's requirement. But just something I think is a point, because Larry called me actually probably almost a year ago. Mm-hmm. And he said, hey, you know, I've got this agenda, and you know, someone said you're a funny guy, and I said, well, I don't know if I'd go that far. But in terms of, you know, framing up a discussion that I thought might be relevant, particularly for many of you, who've either been in the finance role, CEO role, board role, outsider role, whatever, just kind of how do you manage what I call the perfect triangle? Because, you know, Lad, I think you identified you and Donna are the two unfortunate ones here that are stuck being in a public company environment, or at least being involved. And, you know, suffice to say that the world changed. The world took many turns, and, you know, I kind of pictorially tried to describe what this little genesis was. But, you know, prior to Sarbanes-Oxley, prior to Enron, prior to WorldCom, prior to all the madness that existed, obviously, you know, this triangle that existed between management, the board, and I'll call the board the audit committee, and the outside accountant auditor was, I'd say, very gray in terms of who worked for who and under what circumstances, and ties back to something Larry said about corporate governance. You know, prior to 2002, I think many of your larger companies, although when Enron, WorldCom, and Tyco and many other large companies went under, it raised questions about corporate governance. You know, it was really unclear as to kind of who was on first, who was on second, who was on third in terms of specifically responsibilities of working, you know, with us. And when I say us, as a professional, you know, our principal role is providing accounting audit services to and reporting to public companies. We do it for private companies too, but at least in the framework of a formal structure. And up until that point in time, you know, I can share with you many unusual stories, some of which will probably get the hairs on your back going, and hopefully the SEC or PCAOB aren't listening. But I'd say that audit committees were, you know, not as aggressive in their responsibilities of what they were charged with. I think they really viewed, if you were a board member and you were asked to be on the comp committee, that was usually a great committee to be on, because you could bust the chops of the CEO and the rest of the management team. You know, if you were maybe on one of the more strategic or, you know, I'll call them board directional governance, you know, usually good stuff. But audit was, ugh. You know, you had to meet with a geek, you know, at least once a year. And I will share with you, prior to 2002, many of the companies I worked with, and not all of them were just startups. Many of these were companies that, you know, had market caps of over $1 billion, $2 billion and traded. You know, it was really at the purview of, you know, maybe we'd meet once a year with the audit committee. Maybe we'd, and they sometimes would be at the end of a six-hour board meeting. So as you can imagine, the attention span of a board member after 5 hours and 55 minutes of riveting discussions to all of a sudden have, you know, three accountants come in and start walking you through. And I know there's a lot of finance people here, so we need to hold hands and sing kumbaya. We like to think we're excited about what we're doing, but to the outside person saying, okay, you know, are things good, bad, and different, whatever. So it was really kind of a, you know, it wasn't as engaged relationship. And in it, you also had management. And clearly, you know, management had the responsibility, obviously, for working with the auditors, but management also had this unusual role of, you know, approving our compensation, approving normally a selection. Audit committees, more often than not, did not want to get involved in who picked the accountants, whatever. So you kind of had this, what I call an unusual relationship between three parties, all of which had a role and responsibility of corporate governance to shareholders. As I say, I, you know, at times during that period, I had 10, 12 public companies. The practices ranged from meeting, you know, once a year. Some would be quarterly, and we'll talk about how the world changed a little bit. But it was really one of, hey, management, you deal with those guys, you know, we don't want to be involved with that. We trust your judgment. And therefore, you know, how we were reporting, what we were reporting and all that kind of was very directed towards management, and therefore the involvement of the board and their interests sometimes would not really be fully disclosed. So fast forward, you know, 2001 comes around, a company for at least all of us up here in New England. One of my last bad stories, Anderson had the last partners meeting. We should have called it the last supper, but it was 3,000 people. Hey, Richard Herman Taylor, how are you? you know, the last supper was October 2001. Anderson brought all the partners together down in New Orleans. And so it was 2,500 partners globally. You know, Anderson was a $10 billion organization. This is after the Accenture. And I'll never forget, they flashed up four of the biggest clients of Arthur Anderson. You know, and again, living in New England for 24, 25 years as a professional. And they flashed up this name of this company called Enron. And I remember sitting with a bunch of, as I call it, Jamokes from New England, and saying, you know, who's Enron? You know, and I've never heard of this company. And, you know, they put up a presentation indicating it was this fast growing. They had found the new, you know, sauce to solving the energy world, whatever that was. It was like, oh, okay, great, great. And they flash up a picture of the partner who eventually, you know, 3 months later, unfortunately, was printed every day in the New York Times and Wall Street Journal. And just remember leaving there saying, wow, you know, obviously we're a large organization, but here's this company with incredible value. You know, you keep your fingers crossed when I use the word being in a partnership that everything's kind of going well. And so kind of fast forward, you know, when that disaster happened, you know, and I call it a disaster because as it kind of played out, not only in the press, but on the inside, but also for anyone affiliated, whether they had family, friends, clients, you know, investments through that were involved, really created a lot of madness around it. But, you know, when you really kind of stepped back and looked at it, you know, where were some of the breakdowns? Well, you had a very, you know, a pretty named board. You know, if you think about who was on board of Enron, actually, memory serves me right, Vice President Cheney's wife was on the board. They had a number of other key players that were there. You had, on the accounting side, you had a 36-year-old partner dealing with a company whose market cap, I think, was $9, $10 billion, who had only been a partner for 2 years. And for any of you who have dealt with an accounting firm and a partner, you know, he wants some judgment. You know, unfortunately, my gray hair is hereditary. It's not all the stress, Richard, from working in the business. But so you had a little dynamic around that. And then you also had, obviously, a management team that was well ahead of their skis, you know, in terms of a business model when ultimately the movies came out and the novels came out and the stories came out were really some pretty ugly, ugly business practices that masqueraded really a picture, a financial picture of a company that really was not necessarily connected to reality. So, you know, you kind of look at that, and that's on the slide there of, you know, what kind of the board, the historical relationships. Well, you know, they kind of selected the auditor. You know, they kind of had audit committee meetings. You know, they kind of did some self-assessments of who they were, what they were doing. And, you know, generally the interaction was very limited. There were, as I say, some of my clients where the board was active, and therefore the dialogue would be good. But it really involved also a situation where I call it the three wheels were really working, and that was is that management clearly had the credibility and relationship with its board and the respect. You know, the accountants obviously worked directly with management, but worked for the board and the shareholders, and kind of everyone kind of got along. Unfortunately, the Enrons of the world, the Tycos of the world, the WorldComs of the world, unfortunately, many of those are in my past capital of invested earnings in terms of settlements that occurred, really kind of threw a whole new world into it. And so, Vlad, obviously, you have to deal with, and a number of other people, you know, this whole reinvention of Sarbanes-Oxley kind of came out, both from, you know, really redefining roles and responsibilities of all the parties. And what you really saw, the genesis, was it was really kind of making this triangle work and really emphasizing that we, the auditors, are report directly to the audit committee, requiring the audit committee to have financial expertise. I can share with you, I had some audit committees that, you know, unfortunately, and Don, I was kidding you, with a bank where cash is not an asset, it's a liability. Believe me, I had some discussions with some that were challenged. But again, the bar was much lower. Sarbanes-Oxley took the bar up to a much, much higher level. And, you know, for better or worse, was intended, separate from the testing of internal controls and some of the other things, but trying to put in place some of the governance structure that should have been functioning at all companies when, in fact, probably didn't exist. Or if it did exist, it really wasn't functioning anywhere near where you'd want to be. So, you know, when I talk about the perfect triangle, and obviously I want to get some feedback and thoughts from you folks, it's really it's the concept of, you know, the auditors work for the board and the shareholders, but they work with management. Management has a responsibility, obviously, to the board and the shareholders for the performance of the company, and the board has a responsibility for the governance and assisting and overseeing, you know, the good and the bad of what's going on. When everyone's kind of on the same page and working together, it works really well. You know, I'd say post the Sarbanes-Oxley madness and some of the behavior that happened, what you saw is obviously the requirement for an audit committee chair and at least many of its members to have the financial expertise, some of which came from public accounting, some of which didn't necessarily have to come from public accounting, but might have been a financial officer or someone with the history. But enabled, it became kind of a framework for allowing much more, you know, intelligent dialogue around the issues. You know, having done this for 33 years, and many of you have been involved, whether it be as officers on the finance side or other side, it doesn't matter around the industry you're in. The complexity of the accounting rules, whether it be in the nonprofit world, the for-profit regulatory banking, whether it be in technology, the complexity of the rules has changed just dramatically through the years. And trying to stay abreast of it, whether it be a practitioner like myself, who's required obviously to keep my CPA, my certification, we've got an infrastructure totally built around knowledge transfer. But you as a board member coming in without that kind of base or that, you know, how do I want to call it, access to knowledge, it can be really challenging. And so by forcing the boards to really kind of self-assess who's on the board, who's got the skill set, and really kind of putting in place the structure, many of which the Sarbanes-Oxley was intended to, has been very good. You know, obviously it's costly, it's been challenging, the internal control stuff can be very, very painful, and some of it might, you might want to discount the value on that part, but the basic principles of reinforcing governance has been key. Now you might step back, has it worked perfect? You know, again, I'm not a financial services person, but I would share with you that I think something like a Lehman or a Bear Stearns, I think we could all sit around here and have a point of view. Was that a breakdown in governance? Was that just a breakdown in financial markets? Overvalued, overadjusted, and dealing with instruments that really had no sense of what their true value was? And was there a run at the bank? The answer is probably all of them. But at least from a governance standpoint, what's interesting coming out of that is that a lot of the court actions that have happened had the directors and officers' liability has kind of come down some from where it has been. You haven't seen as much than where we were pre-2002. 2002, you know, it was a very, very challenging, when in doubt, you know, the minute you missed earnings, there'd be an allegation of whether it was a misstatement in terms of some sort of an accounting misrepresentation of what might have occurred out there, or, you know, that, you know, the board wasn't doing their fiduciary responsibility. Insurance companies were quick to settle just to get it beyond them. And so I think there's been some good trend where some of the plaintiffs' counsels haven't been able to kind of put their finger and say, look, you had a disinterested board. You know, the rules were set up, the experience requirements, you know, the disclosures that go into proxy statements now for public companies about how often the board meets, you know, those are all good things that unfortunately puts an incremental burden on companies, on everyone playing, but it ensures kind of this framework is kind of working well. So take a stop for a second. That was a lot of talking, right, John? I want to throw it out, just initial reaction, because I want to talk a little bit about where some of the, I have to be careful, we are on tape, right? So I have to watch the words that I use today, but where some of the trends might be going in terms of some of the governance and all that. Yeah.
Well, I guess now that Sarbanes-Oxley has been in for, what, 8 years now? Something
yeah.
Like that. From your perspective, as you go into audit companies, is it work? Is it turned out to be a good set of rules?
I think, you know, Charlie, when you break it down between the internal control side of Sarbanes-Oxley, which got, you know, that's where a lot of the pushback has been. And, you know, the SEC and the PCAOB have kind of changed some of the restrictions. When the rules first came in, it blanketed everybody. And even right. As a small biotech with 10 employees, you had to do craziness. And it really, one, I think, became somewhat anti-competitive. I really do believe that, because here we are in the U.S., forcing all of our companies to go through this, and you've got all outside the U.S. until really some of the foreign countries recently put in place things like it. There was none of that. So I think that side of it was probably went overkill, and then fortunately it's kind of come back some. Some companies used it as an opportunity to kind of rethink their processes. That's good, you know, almost like a refresh. I had one or two clients that really used it as a time to think about how they manage their business from information controls. Wound up, they came up from a project, transformation, coming up with savings, a net of it. I do think the real value was at least starting to put some ground rules around, and particularly in our role as an auditor, who do we work for? Again, we work with management. The board doesn't want to be involved every day, hopefully not. They're not paid enough or carry enough risk. But I think in terms of kind of communicating, okay, well, you guys work for the shareholders and the board, the audit committee represents the board in that role. Therefore, you kind of work and you got a responsibility. I think that was good because, as I say, the behavior prior to the whole Sarbanes-Oxley, the madness of all the restatements and coming out of the .com was boards were all over the place around that. And so I think there was kind of a missing governance piece. I can relate specifically on the Enron, because all those documents eventually became public press. As I said before, you had a 36-year-old partner dealing with probably one of the more challenging, I don't know, for the finance people around here.
The CEO was 40, so.
Yeah, exactly. CEO was 40. You had a chairman who was kind of disengaged running. The CFO was 39, 40. It was a Wall Street. You had Wall Street pumping money at these guys with any idea. And so you had kind of like the perfect disaster ready to happen. Some of this came out. Were there communications to the board of the risks with their business model? The answer is actually there was. Was it to the depth that if you were a board member, you would have wanted to hear from someone independent? Again, the scary part in our business is the first word, we're independent. And the answer was, we didn't. The Anderson team.
Your partner blessed the various off-balance sheet transactions.
Oh, yeah. With what he knew, right. He blessed. Now, there was a lot that he didn't know. But he didn't educate the board. And that's where the board didn't understand. Again, whose responsibility is that? Well, we have a responsibility to explain what we've seen, what we know. But the board also had to have the expertise, taking nothing away from Vice President Cheney's wife. I don't think that she's supposedly a very smart person, but when it comes to financial derivatives and the off-balance sheet stuff these guys were doing, you needed some really, really sharp people. They didn't have it. They had a great name of board people. I remember a company I was taking public in 2005, technology company up here. And again, I thought we had moved to a next stage on this. But CEO, right before they were going public, they said, hey, the investment bankers are telling me I got to get some really smart people on my board. And again, it was your typical, some venture people had been on, kind of one or two friends and family. And, I need an audit committee chair. Can you give me some ideas? Okay, I'll come back to you. So I shot them up three. Said, okay, those all look good. One was an ex, Big Four partner. One was an individual who'd been CFO of three technology companies and had really done a great job with them. Third person was kind of a mixed bag. And he's got General Wesley Clark's resume. And he said, Goldman Sachs is telling me I should bring him on as chairman of the audit committee. Now, again, very patriotic America. He's a wonderful American. I'm not sure that if he's deep into the software revenue recognition rules for a company that's growing like this. And I remember, and that's exactly what I said to the CEO. I said, Andy, forget what the Sarbanes-Oxley, and there are rules, and again, he's probably, maybe he got an A+ in accounting at Army or West Point, wherever he went to school. But at the end of the day, is this the guy that you want, standing there representing? You want him as your buddy. He probably has some big guns and he can blow anyone out. But at the end of the day, is that the person with the technical skills on your board that as we're sitting down and we start talking about, again, I don't want to get into crazy accounting, you all hate me, but multi-element accounting concepts and for software companies, there's concepts of vendor-specific objective evidence. And you don't want that. That's where people got in trouble. And, he laughed. He said, you're right. I said, be his buddy. Have him become your best friend, but not your chairman of your audit committee. And so, to answer your point, I think the control side and some of the regulatory, but I think in terms of reinforcing governance, Lad, you run a public company, so it's a good question probably raised to you in your role. There's probably some incremental cost that's a real pain in the ass, right? That you don't want to see. On the other hand, you know, there's that elimination of risk, I think, that if anything goes south, you as the CEO, you know, can discharge and say, well, I've got a competent audit committee who's got roles and responsibility. You know, they've got to have skin in the game too. When these things all kind of blow up, everyone always starts the pointing. You know, well, we didn't know, and you didn't tell us, and, you know, as I say, it's the perfect storm in terms of three things happening. But if it works well, it really can be effective for the shareholders of the company. Why? Your audit committee and board is educated on what the business, financial, and accounting risks are, and what impact that may have, you know, for companies. And I think, as we know, many companies, when markets are normal, although today I'm never sure what the markets are going to look like. I'm afraid to look at my Bumbleberry when I leave here. But how does that kind of play? You know, you've got some people that then understand what's going on. As the auditor, and I, again, my personal style is, you know, I never tell the audit committee what I haven't told management. So I tell management exactly what I'm going to say to the audit committee. Audit committee, more often than not, in a private session, will ask me maybe some more pointed questions. I will tell management, maybe not necessarily what the answers to all them were, but I'll tell them directionally where they were. But again, as I say, when it's all working well, it should be no surprises. The worst cases, I'll never forget, a war story, technology company out on 495, a public company, it's fortunately changed its name. I was a young partner, and this was a company, they were a software technology company, doing maybe about $150 million in revenue, and they'd had some tough years, and they brought in kind of a new management team. CEO was actually a great guy, not sure if he had the real record. He was more of an operations person, taking nothing away from that. This is a company that really needs someone visionary on the market and technology side. But anyway, comes the end of the year, and the company is ready to put a press release out the day before the board meeting. And again, back then, there wasn't the structure of the boards reading the press release and having a process. I mean, more companies kind of did some things. And they were, you know, the night before the board meeting, they had this big dinner. They were announcing record earnings, okay? The company made $2,993. Period, on $150 million. And you know, they got to earnings. With all their shares, the earnings per share was a dash. It wasn't even a zero. And the only issue was how they got there was they had stripped every reserve off the books. They used to have inventory reserves. They used to have AR reserves. They used to have. And so from a quality of earnings standpoint, you know, the company from a cash flow was in a worse position where they had been. And I met with the CEO, CFO. I said, guys, I'm going to tell the board tomorrow, you are at the bare minimum of reserves. They reserved specifically for what was truly known. There was no cushions. There was no breathing room. And I said, you have one blip, game's over. Oh, yeah, you know, they'll understand. And the CEO, I'll never forget, he said, you know, because we've got the record earnings, before you present tomorrow morning, I'm going to come in with a revised compensation and bonus plan for next year, because, you know, we've turned the company around, all this stuff. And I'm listening, and I'm like, okay, you got from X to $2,993. You know, might have been the lunch that Larry's providing you this afternoon. And I'm like, I'm not sure if that's record, whatever, but okay. He says, don't worry. He says, I'll have you come in and present to the board right after I get them to approve the new comp plan. New comp plan was big bonuses and all this stuff. And I'm like, okay, and again, it was a young partner, but I'm like, you know, I think I've learned enough. This thing could go ugly south. So, you know, show up at 8 o'clock, waiting in the, you know, outside the boardroom. CEO comes out white as a ghost. Board fired him. Said, because he had tried to put this record earnings thing out. They call us in. He said, tell us what you think. I said, you know, this company, again, $2,900. I'll never forget, after 20-odd years, it was just record earnings. I said, they've taken everything off the balance sheet. You got nothing left. You know, look at the cash flow, you know, from operations. The company, you know, is burning cash. You got a lot of intangibles, goodwill, some things that have a lot of legacy value. Probably aren't worth what's there. And again, we're not done yet. And I'll never forget, two of the board members quit. write them all in my presentation. They said, we've heard enough, we're done. And they walked out. So all of a sudden there was one board member left. I was like, I don't think I've ever had this happen. So was it me? And I'm kind of going like this. Maybe I didn't take a shower this morning or whatever.
You didn't want to be responsible. Well, that's chapter 13.
And Charlie, that was it. Two of them just said, we've heard enough, we're done, we're out of here. So they fired the other guy. They brought someone in, company, you know, before they ultimately released. The number was no longer 2,993. It had brackets on it. But to me, that was an example of just the craziness of where, you know, again, trying to level set with management and not, I'll never forget, I said, do you really want to talk to them about a new comp plan? You know, and this whole hype around record earnings when it's $2,993. And so that one didn't go well. But again, you know, if it works well, it's a situation where kind of parties communicate, parties relate. And so I do think, you know, parts of it, and Lad, you know, I don't know how you feel, there's parts of it that maybe are okay, you know?
I mean, Joe? When I started 404 is basically, it really brought the board up. I mean, you had situations where you had a president, chairman, held the same position.
Yep.
In a lot of places. So you had to pick the board. So it's, so when you looked around the table in terms of expertise, they weren't really picked for their expertise, they were picked because he trusted them or he knew them for a long time. So all of a sudden, the landscape changed. And it wasn't just for a court, it was all of a sudden, the SEC went over and kind of bumped the NASDAQ and said, you need to get your rules in line. Because in terms of listing these companies, and then the New York Stock Exchange came in and there was pressure on that side. And then they defined financial expert. And then again, now the board's really evolved in terms of they have really centers of expertise within each board member.
Right? No.
I think that kind of grew out of that.
And I think, John, to your point, I think boards felt more empowered. So compensation, for example, not an accounting issue per se or audit, but generally a pretty sensitive issue. If you think about traditionally how it was done in the past, prior to Sarbanes-Oxley, the CEO figured out what he wanted to pay people in many situations, and that also included stock options. And, you know, there were enough bad practices out there on stock option, backdating and others that you don't want to hear me talk about that. But you know, there was. And I think finally, you know, a comp committee that got, you know, basically emboldened. It doesn't take anything away from the role and responsibility of CEO, but it just created what I call some more governance. And, you know, the friends of Frank, if Frank was the CEO, and, you know, that's how you got on the board and that's how you got your comp. It wasn't a healthy situation, so, yeah.
You know, as I'm sitting here listening to this, I'm putting my board hat on, and I think that most people would agree that Sarbanes-Oxley has been, on the whole, good. I mean, it's sort of raised the professionalism level. But as I hear you talk about this, I get nervous about viewing the system as a very rule-based system in which, well, if we go by the rules, then we're doing the right thing and we're safe. And in fact, Enron, you know, at least within the rules that they thought they were operating on, was doing what they were doing was within the rules, but they were doing the wrong thing. I mean, if you sat back and said, "Is this the right way to be reporting this?" It just was wrong. It was the wrong way to do it. Somebody should have said, okay, well, maybe you can get away. Maybe this is right by the accounting rules,
but it's wrong.
The wrong thing to be doing. Mm-hmm. And I think often, I think when you sit as a member of the board, you have to be asking that question. Okay, our auditor or our CFO or our CEO or whoever it is may say we're doing, you know, we're complying with the technicalities of the rules, but is it the right thing to be doing? Mm-hmm. Do we really understand our business, and are we fairly portraying our business to our stockholders and to ourselves even?
Yeah. No, Rick, I think it's, you know, it's a great point. It's a delicate balance, as, you know, I think the financial people in the room can probably appreciate, but also any executive, including yourself. You know, the U.S., unfortunately, over the last, you know, 15, 18 years, particularly in the accounting side of it, but I would say across the corporate side, is very rules-based, you know, and unfortunately, the international markets tend to at least say that they're more principles-based. And the challenge, and again, I'm not a lawyer, I think all the corporate lawyers recommend their company. It's almost like every press release, what's the first thing the CEO does? He reads the safe harbor statement, right? Let me tell you, you know, what I'm going to say today, right, lad? Someone, either you or someone on your team does. To your point, you know, have we kind of gotten away? And in the challenge becomes, you know, how do you kind of balance the two of them? I don't disagree with you in the sense that as a board member or anyone, understanding and making sure the message is out is how do we really make money is the kind of key. Now, two things that kind of offset that. One is, and I said, you got some very rules-based accounting rules. Like, for example, the Enron. You know, there was this wacky rule that said if you sold off 3% of an entity, so you basically still controlled 97%, you could deconsolidate it under certain circumstances, and you could have transactions with the entity. There was this thing called special purpose entities right there in the accounting. They talk about Lehman. You know, Lehman, the accounting follow down there was this, you know, 105, which enabled you to, I had some assets, I could sell them to you if I gave up 105% of the collateral and you gave me cash back, and I took it back 2 days later. Crazy accounting rules that said you had a transaction, a sale. I agree with you. You step back and say, what have you done? Well, you've done is done a financing transaction, right? I gave you some collateral, get some dough to get some things off my book because I had a repurchase right to get it back.
But shouldn't the auditor be the person who alerts the audit committee when something like that is going on?
Well, and that's, yes. And there is that kind of communication.
They could say you're within the rules, but.
Yes.
And, I mean, it just seems to me that's
yeah.
The few experiences I've had with auditors, that's the attitude they've had is.
Yeah.
But can I say, I mean, but it's management too. I mean,
yeah.
I've been focusing on this word interaction right here.
Yeah.
And yeah, I was a former partner too, so I've seen both sides of the house.
Yeah.
And it's everyone's responsibility because management needs to interact with the board, the whole board and the audit committee, and be honest and forthright and go to them and use them and say, this is what we're going to do or what's your strategy and get involved. The audit committee needs to ask questions and be you've got to have some experts on it, but they also need to be smart enough to ask. And yeah, the auditors need to share. But I think a lot of it, you got to bring it up and know the business. And I think that's what I've seen change from mm-hmm. the days as auditors to now, is the boards get more involved in knowing the business. Because if you don't know the business when you're sitting on the board, especially the audit committee, you're not going to get it. And everyone needs to interact, and everyone has a role and responsibility to interact. And the auditors especially, they need to, I mean, I know that I didn't know my businesses as well, because
mm-hmm.
I think I went today.
Yep.
When I was an audit partner. And you've got to. You can't go in and just say, oh, I'm just going to say, what is GAAP and here's the financials. You have to know the business. And I think that's what's really changed since the 2002 era to today, is boards being held responsible for knowing the business and management being responsible to say, the board's there for you. It's there for the shareholders, but it's there for you as well.
Yeah.
And everyone sharing and interacting. It has to be high interactive.
Oh, yeah. And Donna, that's to your point. That's why when I said to Larry, this triangle, kind of how does it work? Because at the end, to your point, if there's a breakdown, if the auditors aren't open enough in sharing with the audit committee after discussing with management where the key risks are of the business and where the company, what I usually do with some companies is I kind of color code the risk areas. You know, where the company is on that scheme. You know, are they in the middle? Are they in the high end, low end? Kind of what's their game? And it's helpful, you know, as a board member to do. But to your point, if the board/audit committee doesn't know enough about the business, then, and that's what really pre-2002, you had a lot of moving targets. And, you know, the challenge in the U.S. of the rules-based is, and these accounting rules for any of the accountants and finance people here, I kid people, back in 77 when I was graduating from BC, there were 5 FASBs, okay, and FASBs are the Financial Accounting Standard Board statements for any of the non-accountants in here. They came out like once a year, and you know, and I figured I was looking at a career, and I said, this is great. You know, they come out like one new pronouncement a year. I got to understand it. You know, great. Well, you know, fast forward, you know, one, there are no more FASBs anymore. They've got new codification letters for them. But they got well into the triple digits. Some of the literature, particularly as it relates to financial instruments, the derivatives that Lehman and the Enron, and those are the ones that can get really ugly because there's big judgments. They're so complicated. In some ways, they're not complicated because at the end of the day, if everyone stepped back and said, you know, who's really at risk and, you know, is someone really going to make money in this, then you might get there. And that was the issue with Enron, was all those were just financing tricks. They were all financing tricks.
In fact, he was gushing, he was burning cash.
Oh, he's burning cash. And he had Wall Street saying, you know, we'll send you more candy. He played the card with all the bankers. And so he had every banker just kind of saying, I'll give you 20. Okay, well, we're going to put these assets, dump them in. And, you know, again, the one part of that that I don't think anyone in this room or anyone can do, but when, if there is a fraud, and unfortunately, you know, frauds exist, and can't tell you, at least once a year, there's something that goes on a client that I continue to shake my head that happens. But if there's an intention to deceive, which there, you know, there were a lot of side letters, you know, options to rebuy back these assets, they were never really sold. You know, unless you trip into that, because the CFO down at Enron back then was lying, right, and kept it all off books.
Well, so was the CEO.
CEO had skin in the game.
Trust me, I know Jeff Skilling. Yeah. He's a classmate of mine.
This Ooh, is, there you go. He Jeff, cheated back then, Charlie?
Jeff was a very, very, very smart guy.
Yeah.
The CFO wasn't particularly, he was okay, but yeah. He wasn't smart.
Yeah.
Trust me, Jeff Skilling knew every single transaction backwards and forwards.
Yeah. And unfortunately, 25 years from now, when he comes out of jail, I mean, the price, but even the WorldCom, the Scott Sullivan, you know, with his accounting entries that were all, you know, jammed in at the end and all these write-ups. So, you know, to your point, Donna, when it all works, it's good. But here in the U.S., and it's one of the real disconnects, is the rules-based, not only from the accounting, but even if, you know, if we had a corporate lawyer here, Jeff Rudman from WilmerHale, he would say to you, as advising you, if you want to avoid litigation, you're going to do your best defense is we follow the rules. You follow the rules, you can't. Use judgment where you didn't think the rules were applicable, but that's the rules. That's where you open up. And again, wish it wasn't that way. And particularly in the accounting world, you know, there's, you know, you hear about the convergence in the accounting world. We're going to international.
That was exactly what I was going to ask.
Yeah. And
what do you think the likelihood of?
It's way out there, Charlie. Let me see. I'm hoping that years ago, fantasy was to be Tiger Woods caddy. I don't think that's a fantasy anymore. And nor being general manager for the Red Sox after last night. Don't think I want that day job either. But, you know, I think, you know, unfortunately what's happened is two things. One, that's been deferred out till probably 15, 16. They're picking off some topics and trying to get convergence sooner. Leases, for example, operating. There will be no such thing for any finance person around here. A lease is a lease. A lease goes on the financial statements, regardless of whether it's what used to be, like, Larry, your lease here on the Stiebel and Associates balance sheet, if it's more than 1 year, it would go on your books as an asset and a liability, the revenue recognition. They're trying to get some convergence. And the principles-based, it's interesting. I think everyone a few years ago said,
market.
Yeah, and the mark-to-market and the financial instruments. You know, everyone said a couple of years ago, wow, it's going to be great. You know, the Europeans use them more, principles-based and whatever. I'll share with you, you know, going through some of the detail on some of this. You know, some of it's not great accounting. It gets to even, you know, particularly in the revenue world, which is a world I live in dealing with technology and other companies, it's got some modeling that leads to some very upfront, well before the cash cycle. I used to have a client, and to this day I loved him for years. He used to always say, I don't care about this gap crap, George, you know, generally accepted accounting principles. It's all garbage. If I have more cash at the end of the day than I had at the beginning of the day, that's a good day. And, you know, I used to say, no, but, you know, it could be because you mortgage money. And you got it. He said, if I have more cash at the end of the day, the beginning of the day, I'm in a better spot. And you reflect on it that, unfortunately, the accounting rules, and in Enron is a typical, you know, by using some accounting things, their cash flow, they were out of cash. right? Charlie, I mean, they were burning cash, but yet they showed record earnings. Why? Because they were able to use accounting gimmicks. So the principles-based, that's particularly some areas, I think there'll be a convergence, but it's going to be a few years out, and they'll pick off some of the topics. You know, one thing in the last pages in here, before, and obviously open up more dialogue, but just so you have a sense, over in Europe, another byproduct is, it's a real hot issue now, maybe more for our industry, but as board members, you're probably going to hear and see, or as finance people, is the EU has got a green paper out there on a topic of something called mandatory auditor rotation. Now, Italy actually does it now. And again, I'm not sure if we want to follow the Italian world, right? We could follow the Greek world. We're not sure where. That's only levity, right, Larry?
Prime Minister owns the country.
Yeah, I know, exactly. We want to be his BFF, if anywhere in this world. But it's a... Italy has it, France has kind of something called joint auditors for listed companies, and the individual who just took over the IMF from the guy, Dominic Strani, the guy who got in trouble, she's a big proponent on this. Yeah, she is big on, from a competitive standpoint, thinking it's good. Some of that is kind of rearing its head, you may hear of it.
CIOB just came out.
Yeah, the PCOB, exactly. Yeah, and Donna, you know, it's interesting. As you know, someone will say, the firms obviously are in a very self-serving position because, you know, people say, you guys should get out ahead of this, go down the PCOB. The last thing they want to hear is from the accounting firms.
I think industry needs to come out.
Industry,
I
mean, and the audit committee.
I don't know who's familiar with who's on audit committee and boards, but to me, it's one, you're taking away the role away from the audit committee. So
yeah.
You're saying the audit committees aren't competent enough to select their auditors. And it takes, 3 years probably for auditors to really understand a company. So in the fourth year, you're going to be rotating them. And there's a big issue with competition.
Yes.
You know, there's no one. So in the marketplace, you know, you can do Ernst & Young and PwC probably, you know, and then you can do KPMG. And so, you know, it's just any marketplace, you're not going to get more than two firms. What are they going to just hand back and forth?
Donna,
it's I don't want to train my auditors. You're sitting on the other side of the fence.
Yeah.
I don't want to train my auditors. You can see at least a 20% increase in cost. It's
Donna, I hope you write that letter.
Well,
thank you for doing it. But
industry needs to come together. I really think it needs to come across the board in the companies in Massachusetts and just fight this off because it is stupid.
Oh, yeah. And Donna, thank you. I didn't pay Donna to say that. and I appreciate it. But no, you hit it. And please. Yeah.
Like,
yeah. Well, but as you say, and again, the self-serving for our business, what you just said, for our business, the only challenge of moving people around from an economic standpoint as a partner, it'd be a boom. I mean, if people think Sarbanes-Oxley made us multi-trillionaires, this is, you know, from heaven. Every 5 years, you know, we pick up GE, we get Raytheon, PwC, gets Coca-Cola, flipping around. Companies won't have a choice.
You're going to be getting consent forms from four companies.
Exactly. And with all the complexities, so many companies use professional services, you know, your accountant. Even Sarbanes-Oxley was very clear about permitted services, and that was good. You know, I came from, as Richard knows and John, my prior world at Anderson. I mean, Anderson, you know, had Anderson Consulting. We were the largest consulting firm in the world. That ship went without any money, but that's a whole separate issue over many Diet Cokes. But even back in the 90s, when as a partner, with an accounting firm, you had this consulting firm that was just, you know, recognized as one of the best consulting firms in the world, Anderson Consulting, eventually becoming Accenture. And you'd be out there, okay, how can we audit this company if Accenture's in here? And, you know, we're billing $100,000 for an audit, and they're billing $5 million on a systems installation that's all their people doing the work. This doesn't feel right. And again, until Sarbanes-Oxley, where there was some definition of what were permitted services and not, and put some restriction. But, you know, Donna, you hit the nail on the head. It's one that, as you all will hear, there is, PCOB is floating it out there. Europeans, and again, the last thing we need is another flu coming from Europe. We've had enough over the last couple of months, if not longer. But, and the impact, but as I said to people, this is just like Sarbanes-Oxley. We'll be multi-trillionaires because companies won't have any choice. Firms are going to get boxed out, you know, for every firm does work at other companies. So, for example, we do valuation work for many PwC clients, well, valuation work is kind of almost like on behalf of management, so therefore we can't be the auditors. Well, likely at that company, Deloitte Touche is doing the internal audit work. They can't do it. So you may say, well, that's great. It's going to increase the competition, which, again, I'd love it to be more competitive at that standpoint. But then companies will have the challenge of, will those firms have the skill set? You know, and again, we just talked about challenging accounting and, you know, taking nothing away from the non-national firms, but it puts tremendous pressure on them to build the kind of resources, skill set to deal with a GE. I mean, I don't even know how you'd go at a GE. They've worked with KPMG for 95 years. GE is a beast. To your point, Don, I think you could probably spend 5 years on it and never understand the company, and you'd have to change firms. So as board members, you know, it's just something that's out there, you know, and that there's looking at what boards should be doing different, and I agree with you. I think that is a diffusing of what you've tried to do. You empowered your audit committees as part of Sarbanes-Oxley to step it up, get smart people, you know, have them ask tough questions, deal with the auditors directly. You know, I deal with all my audit committee chairs directly, just like I deal with the CFOs. As I say, when it works, everyone's on the same page. That's what it was intended to be. But if you're going to sit there and then say, well, you know, we might as well become, you know, employees of the U.S. government. Now, 5-6 years ago, I would have been pleased on that. My pension would have been guaranteed. But that's a joke. But now, given away the U.S. economy and what's going on in Washington, which is a whole separate two-hour board discussion, would just be a constraint. So, you know, again, you know, I think I'm perfect at a 10-minute drill. So open up for a couple of questions.
Before. Just a quick question. In terms of the you know, this triangle.
Yep.
If you look at a 10-K, in terms of the number of pages that were included in the 10-K, say 10 years ago to today, right? You know, you almost defy somebody to be able to read it and understand it.
Yeah.
Including members of the audit committee.
Yeah.
Right? So in this triangle, is it, you know, is it a member of the audit committee or the board looking over the management, looking over the auditors, and everyone's saying, does everybody understands this document?
Yeah.
Right? Because we're gonna basically publish it, we're gonna basically file it. And I quite frankly, I think with the amount you talk about rules based, the more and more this gins forward, the more and more the economy becomes complex,
mm-hmm.
disclosure becomes complex.
Mm-hmm.
Quarterly filings, the annual filings, to the point that you really wonder if anybody fully understands what's being filed in some cases.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know how anyone feels in terms of sitting on boards when you look at a 10-K
or a 10-Q. Was a time that much of that information was gleaned by the analyst community,
mm-hmm.
right? And they talked to management, interviewed management, right? And they're sort of not allowed to do that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Right, because these private conversations,
yeah,
right,
those are taboo,
sort of, right? And the accounting profession, I'm not sure I agree with this necessarily, but they have at the ivory tower level become sort of the disclosers, right? This rulemaking body that says anything the investment community might ever want to know, we should have that in there somewhere in yet another footnote, right? And I'm not sure that part's productive, right? And I sort of, you know, mm-hmm. agree in general. Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
We hear the complaint about, some complaints, some applaud, excess regulation, excess cost, not competitive.
Yeah.
On the other hand, this whole purpose, right, your role in life and the SEC's role in life and mission, right, is to protect the integrity of the
mm-hmm.
capital markets.
Mm-hmm.
If you have honest capital markets, right? Notwithstanding,
yeah. Yeah.
notwithstanding, you know, Lehman Brothers and AIG and so on, but notwithstanding, those efficient capital markets should make us more competitive.
Yeah.
Is it working?
$1 million question, Neil. Honestly, do I think it's working? I think the capital markets, in given because there's so many different constituencies, and you think about now, so much of Wall Street is hedge funds. Who their interest and what they want vary. I don't know. I think we're the only long-term holders, right, in the equity markets now. And so you've got varying interest, and therefore I think, you know, a case like a Bernie Madoff, you know, in the perfect world, if all the markets were self-regulating, should never have happened. And unfortunately it did, and the fallout of it was just tremendous. And so unfortunately, as I tell people, I don't know the day comes when people like us don't have jobs, and I know it's scary, like a full-time employment act, but there's no other way, I guess, Neil, to make sure that there's at least some certainty. Maybe it's like the ivory soap, 99.46%. If we can get it right 99% of the time, that's wonderful. And I think it gives some comfort to the investors. Yeah, please.
Isn't one measure to the question where companies are listed as a measure of, I mean, part of its integrity, but where a company's listing and where less competitive today?
Yeah.
Just by the numbers of where the listing
is. In the real world is what's happened is for, you know, compared to 20 years ago, 20%, maybe higher of our GDP in terms of productive capacity is in the private equity market. Mm-hmm. It's not on the listed market anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have a private equity client, they tend to run, you know, for who've got large companies in their portfolio, they want it run as though it was a public market. In part, because that may be the exit. But it's also because they need to know, even more importantly than, you know, when the guy said, you know, I've got more cash in the evening than I do in the morning, I've had a good day. That's the way private equity looks at their company.
Yep.
And they literally monitor daily, you know, your accounts receivable, your inventory, and your revenue base. It's a reporting requirement from almost every private equity group that I know of that they expect their companies to report daily. Mm-hmm. So they're keeping close tabs on what is the operating capacity. But yes, because of the inefficiencies of the public market, the private equity market has boomed. Okay,
yeah.
And it's just boomed in the last 20, 25 years. It was at the EMY Venture Conference this morning.
Yep.
And we were talking about how, you know, 10 years ago was, of course, the peak of the bubble of the Internet 1.0, but it was 10 years ago, 80% of your venture companies went public.
Mm-hmm.
Today, less than 20% of your venture companies go public, in part because of the complexity of the rules, but in part because the equity market's getting a little bit smarter, and so M&A is tending to be the exit, not the public markets.
Yeah.
Again, the effect of the private equity movement.
Yeah. Charlie, what I'd add, and said 5 minutes, Sandy, just if I could, one thought I want to leave you all with that obviously you're kind of getting at it, about which markets are even good. Obviously the sleeping giants, although they're not sleeping anymore, you know, the China, India, Brazil, Russia, you know, the BRIC companies, countries, they are truly, if they can get their life around how to deal appropriately in regulatory, they will ultimately develop competition to the U.S. financial markets. I mean, think about it. That's where all the capital is. China, I mean, the SEC, I think almost any technology company that now is doing business in China realizes that they're going to give up their IP. They have to play in that market, but, you know, if you're depending upon the nature of the industry that you deal with over in China, many of those companies have to be owned by Chinese nationalists. So you can put in structures from an accounting standpoint to control it. At the end of the day, what happened with Yahoo, when they set up a subsidiary through Chinese nationalists, the guy took the business out from underneath them. There's no restrictions. If China and those countries can get their regulatory world in shape, that investors will really have more confidence, then I think there's going to be a much more pressure on the U.S. Won't be. And that's just a view, but I got to tell you, you know, there's so much capital, but there still is some angst from people because, you know, everyone realized they got to play, but it's the wild, wild west. Yeah?
On the for-profit side, because I'm really for-profit side, when there's an audit committee meeting at some point,
yes, good practice. Good practice. I will share with you, up until Sarbanes-Oxley, that wasn't a practice. And every once in a while, maybe some meetings I stay, but at least once or twice a year, management leaders.
Well,
Euler.
I want to ask the final question.
Yes, sir.
You in your career, are there any questions that audit committees have not asked that you wish they had asked? Or are there any, if you've gone to an audit committee and after the conclusion of the audit committee, said, you know, I wish the committee had asked me questions on X, Y, Z.
Yeah. Great question, Larry. I tell you that and maybe it's my style also, I like to lead people. I want them to be informed. I want them to be knowledged. If I think there's an area, and again, I'll be open because we're required if there's disagreements with management, I'm going to kind of lay it out. And typically, the benefits of all this is almost all that gets kind of dealt with before. But I'm trying to think. Probably, I honestly do believe that I think laying out everything and pointing and making sure at the end, you guys, everyone okay, it's, I think John's point earlier, it's almost like the Thelma and Louise, at the end of the movie where they kind of go off the cliff together. Right before the K's get filed, I look at the board and management, and I say, all right, guys, boys and girls, it's Thelma and Louise time, what do you think? And, but I think because it's now functioning better, there is less of that. My story about the board firing the CEO, and two of the audit committee members quitting in the middle of the meeting, that probably has happened somewhere in the United States this year. I thank the Lord it hasn't happened with me. But I just think that there's a better sensitivity around it. So, anyway, hopefully that answered.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your time, guys. I greatly appreciate it. All right.
If you would like to leave at this point, please do so. If you, any of you would like to stay and talk to George, please do so.
No, I wanted to talk to him because I wasn't to see it. In fact, one of my old partners, Arthur Anderson, John Scott, who was my auditor when I was a kid.
If you drain the pool, but
thanks very much. Thank you so much for having me. Okay.
I've got. I'm gonna give you mine. I'm gonna make sure Larry has
new chair.
Thank you very much.
It's rumored to be running for.
I started.
Oh, you did. Oh God. Yeah, the old accounting rules.
In France, of course. In France, it's just standard operation.
I know.
They're all operators.
Alan, I do. I've got a 25th-year-old birthday.
I'll make sure at the conference this morning.
I haven't seen him in
He's great.
And he got out the door before.
Thank you for reminding me, Charlie. He's the guy who got his capital out, called me the day and said, how's it feel? I said, that's a small one. Thank you. Look forward to catching up with you again.
Alan, yeah, please do.
I need your advice.
Yes, sir.
It is.
But let's take a
look at that.
By the way, I'm playing ball.
If I make money, I join on your organization.
He was one who had the statistics by year. He said, you're 23 out of 24.
I was like, okay, make me a dog. Richard Herman Taylor, how are you?
All right.
So here's the question.
These are not forums.
It's sort of what their
sphere of caring about who they want to know.
But it is, they are very distinct.
Yeah, that's right. That's why I'm trying to know what they're doing.
It's in the group. Which is buyout.
How are you?
My definition of private equity is buyout.
You don't mind if I write down what you're telling me?
No. Remember me in your will. I almost never get paid. Private equity. We're trying to coach this model today. Venture capital.
I turn the whistle back in.